Well, we're going to get started. We want to get you guys out on time for lunch, and we also hope to leave some time for questions at the end. And just to start, want to introduce who we are. All three of us are colleagues at Nikao Counseling Center, which is a Christian counseling center here in town. Personally, I'm Josh Walsh. I've been a counselor for just over a decade and have worked extensively with teens and kids, and so have worked a lot with anxiety and depression over that time. Have considered it a privilege to work with teens, have considered it a privilege for parents to entrust teens to me. I don't take that lightly at all. We've been members at Watermark for 13 years, father of four, and that's a little bit about me. I'll pass it to Ann. You want to introduce who you are?
Hi, I'm Ann Key. And I've been at Nikao Counseling Center since 2005, been practicing for 28 years in counseling, and I'm also a parent. I have three kids, and I've walked through adolescent years, and I'm walking through them right now, 21, 20, and two boys, and then a 15-year-old daughter. So I don't necessarily work with teenagers, but work with parents, couples, marriage. But I'm a parent and can speak to that.
And my name's Happy Madden. I have been a counselor at Nikao for about 3 years now. I work mostly with teenage girls and young adult women, kind of ages 11 up to around 30. I am soon to be a parent. I will become a parent to a little baby in March. So I'm here to learn alongside all of you, and I think that about covers it.
All right. We are so grateful that you guys are entrusting this time to us, and it says a lot about y'all to dedicate a weekend like this weekend to better yourself as parents, to equip yourself, and with that being said, with the topic of our breakout being teen mental health, anxiety, and depression. We know that there may be a variety of different groups in the room right now. One, you may have a teen that's currently struggling, and if that's the case, know that that can be an incredibly difficult place to be, an overwhelming place to be, a sad place to be. And we hope that as a result of this time, that you can feel better equipped in coming alongside your teen. We know that there also may be a group in here that has a teenager or maybe someone who isn't quite a teenager, and you're hearing about just the rate in which teenagers are struggling. And it's a pretty alarming rate, and we'll talk to that a little bit with some statistics. And as a result of being here, you're wanting to better get ahead of it, have some knowledge if that is something that in the event comes to be part of the struggle with one of your teenagers. Whatever the reason is that you're here, we hope that you feel better equipped to understand what anxiety and depression are, know how to better detect it, and how to best come alongside. And before we jump to the bulk of the material, we just want to speak to as Christians too, that you as parents, and this goes across the board for whatever it is that you're interacting with your child, teen with, that you are going to best be able to be equipped to come alongside that child as you seek to grow in your relationship with him. He is the great healer, and we know that as parents we have a responsibility, but upon ourselves we cannot create that change. Also, fostering your teenager to have a growing and abiding relationship with the Lord is a part of this as well. And we're not going to speak to in this breakout how to best foster a spiritual walk as you seek to come alongside your parent. We'll leave that for different breakouts. But we recognize that that is a vital and important part of this. As we hop to the bulk of the material, we also want to speak to just the hope. I mentioned a little bit ago that this can feel like a heavy topic at times, overwhelming at times, but there is great hope. First and foremost, there's hope found in the Lord, who is working in all things. And we also know, as counselors who consistently work with people that are dealing with depression and anxiety, we can see them progress as we meet with them. And so we have firsthand evidence in that as well. There is hope, and we want to speak to that as well. So as we hop in, we're going to talk about some of the mental health and maybe even describe what it is that we're even talking about when we use the term mental health, look at some current statistics, as I alluded to a second ago, and with that, I'll pass it off to Anne.
So I'd say as a generation of parents and adolescents, we have so much more knowledge about mental health. I mean, you probably, if you have adolescents, they're probably throwing around words like, I'm so bipolar, and I'm depressed, or I'm anxious. There's a lot of language around that. And so you wonder, is it just that we're more educated, and our children are more educated, or are anxiety and depression really on the rise? And so we wanted to get to some statistics and just really kind of confirm that it is, that anxiety and depression has increased. So just to get to some of these, just so you have some information on that, a CDC study published earlier this year found that from 2011 to 2021, Here's a few. Nearly 60% of adolescents reported feeling sadness every day for at least 2 weeks during the previous year, twice the rate among boys. The rate of major depressive episodes among U.S. adolescents increased by more than 52% between 2005 and 2017. And then between 2007 and 2018, the suicide rate among American adolescents increased by nearly 60%. And then on to the next slide. I'll make sure I'm in the right order. The number of teen suicide attempts in the U.S. increased significantly between 2019 and 2021, so, you know, right during those COVID years. And at some point in their development, 30% of children and adolescents will experience anxiety, and 80% never receive help. Am I on the right slide? Okay, so next one. So some gender differences between boys and girls. So I said 1 in 3 teenagers struggling with anxiety. Should I get to that one? Girls are twice as likely as boys to suffer from anxiety, but boys are taken in for treatment more often, which is an interesting statistic. And if you have anxiety, your kids are 7 times more likely to deal with it themselves. And then finally, 1 in 3 teen girls has considered taking their own life. Pretty staggering statistics. So as we move into that, Happy has a couple other things to say, but Happy did a great, like, continuing ed for our team. They talked a lot about why, and I don't know if you want to go into that a little bit, and then she has a few other things to share.
Yeah, so like Anne was saying, our staff was kind of asking ourselves, is there really a marked increase in anxiety, depression among teens today? Or are more people just talking about it, so more people are coming forward? And there's probably a little bit of both, but there really has been a marked increase in just rates across the board. And there's kind of 3 overarching theories as to why that is, that research has been delving into over the past few years. One being everyone's favorite, technology and screen time. There has been a noticeable uptick in depression and anxiety since the smartphone came out and over the years as kids have more and more access to technology and screens. But there also was some research showing some benefits to having access to text messaging, social media as a means of peer support and connection. So it's not all terrible, but that was one major theory. Another one being the nature of which children have less independence to roam, explore, make mistakes, and build resilience now. So that theory kind of focused more on parenting styles and how, as a society, parenting has become more and more kind of controlled, and there's not as much freedom for kids to roam about and to figure things out on their own. And that is not to blame parents. I think a lot of that has to do with where we're at as a society, probably growing crime rates, all sorts of things across the board. But there was a study done earlier this year, I think it was in January, that was published in the Journal of Pediatrics about how the decrease in independence that kids face, even at a very young age, has shown and correlated to an increase in depression and anxiety. The third theory that researchers have looked at has more to do with social institutions and the decline of trust and engagement that we as Americans have with our social institutions. So churches, schools, government, local community, people just are so much more isolated and living very individual lives, living very polarized lives. And so that has increased loneliness, depression rates, and even just not feeling a sense of deeper purpose and meaning in life. And ultimately, what social institutions provide is a safety net and a support system where kids feel like, oh, I can make mistakes, I can fall on my face and build resilience, and I'm not going to be alone in that. I'm going to have a support system around me. So this next slide shows a graph from the big CDC study that we all looked at, and it really just looks at the factor that kids feeling connected to their school and to people at their school, how much that helped their mental health. So you can see, I think it's on the right-hand side, probably twice the rates of suicidality and depression, and those are among the kids that felt no sense of connection at school. So that just is a good example to show you how feeling connected to people around you, to institutions that you're a part of, really does help with mental health, and feeling disconnected and isolated sadly really contributes to those increased rates of not wanting to be alive, thinking about taking your own life.
So what is mental health? Just going to give a brief definition. Mental health refers to a person's emotional, psychological, and social well-being. It encompasses one's ability to handle stress, maintain healthy relationships, make sound decisions, and cope with life's challenges. Mental health is not about feeling good all the time. Instead, it's about having the right feelings at the right time and being able to manage those feelings effectively. So when we talk about teenagers, it's hard to know what is anxiety and what is depression. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about what's happening in the teenage brain, and then we'll kind of move into like what is anxiety and what is depression, and how can we figure out the difference. So first of all, teenagers are going through puberty, so they're experiencing tremendous changes in their body and their hormones, and so that's going to obviously impact how they feel and think and act. But there's also a major overhaul going on in their brain. And I'm not a neurologist, and I'll try to explain this in a brief summary. But basically, their brain is breaking down and rebuilding. So it's reconstructing. So the brain is developing 4 to 5 times more neurons than any other time in their life as an adult compared to us. And then they're also pruning all those unused neurons. And then they're also increasing the speed so they can think faster and quicker. So this process starts about 10 or 11. I know that's a very botched description, but it starts about 10 or 11. And for girls, it's over about 22. And for boys, about 24. But as a result, they're experiencing really exaggerated emotions and mood swings. So you'll hear, this is the best day of my life. And then the next day, it's the worst day I've ever had. I hate my school. I love my school. I love this boy. I don't like this boy. I mean, it's just like you're on a roller coaster of emotions. And so it's hard to know, like, is this normal? Like, and it is normal to some extent. And then when does it become more serious? So just going into that, I mean, some of it's just very typical of teenagers, and I think they need a lot of grace because they don't, I mean, they're struggling with their own mood swings and emotions, and it's hard for them to understand what's happening inside of them. But and then so let's get on to kind of anxiety and depression symptoms.
Okay, so I'm going to speak a little bit to depression and suicidality, which ironically, even though my name is Happy, are two of my favorite focus areas within the mental health world. I used to work in a research center that focused on depression studies. But depression, these symptoms are just things to be looking for in your teen. So feeling low, feeling down, staying in bed, isolating in their room for excessive amounts of hours, oversleeping or undersleeping. Same goes with appetite, so like dramatically increased appetite, overeating or undereating, having no appetite at all. And the duration you're really going to want to look for is 2 weeks or more. That's where we kind of start to diagnose major depressive disorder. The one other factor I love to tell parents of teenagers is that when we think about depression, we think about kind of sad, Eeyore, feeling womp womp all the time. But in teenagers specifically, the number one presenting symptom of depression is actually irritability. Later in life, it's going to look probably a little bit more like sadness and feeling down. But with teenagers, it's going to be that irritability, that being on edge, kind of moody and angsty, which I bet a lot of y'all are thinking, sounds like my teenager, sounds like my teenage experience. So it can be really hard to discern at first, okay, is this just stereotypical teenage angst or is this something more? And that's where you're going to want to look at the duration of how much it's coming up, because irritability is a normal thing that we all experience. But when it's kind of outweighing the situation, like Anne talked about earlier, that's where you might raise a few red flags and start to dig deeper. And then for suicidality, sadly, we all know that suicide is really just having thoughts or intent to end one's life. And I also like to tell parents that suicidality kind of exists on a spectrum. It's a really heavy and really scary topic, so we can kind of raise our red flags quickly, which I think ultimately is a good thing, to err on the side of safety. But just to know that clinically we see on the lighter end of the spectrum, passive suicidal ideation, which really just those kinds of thoughts are, gosh, like, I wish I weren't here. I don't even want to wake up in the morning tomorrow. Like, I wish I could go to bed and never wake up. And those are really heavy and sad thoughts. But those aren't necessarily like time to take my kid to the hospital. That's more something we can work through in counseling and enter into with them to help build some hope and build some purpose. And then on the more extreme side, there's having a suicidal plan or an intent to end one's life. And that would be the time to seek out help immediately, if necessary, to go to an emergency room. One other really important factor that research has shown is that asking about suicidal thoughts does not increase the likelihood that your child will attempt suicide or that anyone you know will. Asking the question, hey, I'm kind of worried about you. Have you had thoughts of ending your life? Have you had thoughts that you might be better off dead? Those kinds of like very direct questions can actually be very helpful at helping the person feel known and then feeling comfortable opening up and seeking out help. So if you have any suspicion, even if it's really awkward and you're totally wrong, it's usually worth it to just ask the question if someone is struggling with suicidal thoughts.
Thanks, Abby. Want to talk a little bit about anxiety, but before I do, I want to have us kind of have a picture in mind first, just to kind of help us. What I want you to try to envision is you're in Colorado. It's great, been a great family vacation. You all decide to go on a family hike on a trail that you've never been on before. And about midway through that hike, you start to hear and see some rustling up ahead of you. And before long, you recognize there's a bear right there. What happens in that moment is you're going to have a physiological response to that. One, your mind is going to be racing with a lot of different thoughts. You're going to have a physiological response. Heart rate's going to increase. You're going to feel more sweaty. You're going to have a real reaction to an immediate fear and danger right in front of you. And the reason why I start there is I think sometimes in culture, we synonymously use fear and anxiety interchangeably, and they're very different. Anxiety is something that's more of a perception of a fear rather than a response to immediate fear right in front of you. And so to go back to the bear analogy for a second, let's envision that we plan on going on the family vacation, but instead of being on the hike, we are in our room packing for the family vacation, and we're thinking about going on a hike. And then all of a sudden, before long, our mind is flooded with thoughts of, well, what if I come across a bear? And then as a result of that thought, it spirals into more thoughts, where you then have the same type of emotional, physiological reaction like you had when I described of actually coming in contact with the bear. But the biggest difference is you're at home in the safety of your room, and there's no bear around you. And just to kind of talk about the difference, again, anxiety is a feeling very similarly to like you are in real danger, but you aren't. And it's helpful to just kind of navigate through what is it that our teen, if we're saying that they're struggling with anxiety, what is it that they're actually experiencing? difference between fear and anxiety there. And you know, anxiety presents itself in, you know, excessively worrying, feeling restless and on edge, dread of what is to come, difficulty thinking about anything other than the present worry. And I think the challenge at times, and we alluded to this a little bit earlier, Anne was speaking to it, is that it can be hard to distinguish between depression and anxiety because they can present themselves so similarly at times. The biggest way of understanding if it's anxiety or depression is to understand kind of what is the thought process that's attached to what we are externally observing. And the thought process is different in a lot of times by depression being connected to a thought of what has happened in the past, and anxiety being a thought of something that you're concerned about happening in the future. Like I said, we can see an avoidance of activities, isolating, irritability, noticing changes in grades and big personality changes, but it's more of the thought process that's different in regard to depression and anxiety, and so trying to foster, and we'll talk about this later when we talk about how to concretely try to come alongside your teen, but trying to foster some open communication that you have a better understanding of what is the thought process that they're going through is so helpful in being able to navigate through what is it that they're actually experiencing. With depression and anxiety, we know that the quicker that we address, the better shot we have of mitigating complex issues from setting in more long-term as they progress through teen years and then into adulthood. So like with most things, early detection, earlier interaction, the better shot we have at actually making good headway. And anxiety can be far-reaching in the impact of a teen. It can impact their emotional well-being, their physical health can be affected, and also just their social development as they progress through the teen years. Anxiety can look differently. It can play itself out in a few different ways that we see in teens, and more times than not, four big ways in which it presents itself. Generalized anxiety, kind of what we typically think of when we hear of anxiety. Social anxiety, so pulling back from social situations, having lots of struggles socially, feeling like they're not apart at all, just find themselves isolating there eventually. Phobias, which, again, that gets thrown around a lot, but what we're talking about is a persistent, excessive, unrealistic fear of an object would be a phobia. And then panic attacks. And panic attacks, something that, you know, when we hear a teen in session say, hey, I've had a panic attack, we're not going to just assume that they've had a panic attack. We want to actually understand what is it that you're actually describing, to actually see, is it true that you are actually having a panic attack? And so similarly, as we encourage parents, it would be similar. Like, let's not just hop to on the train of they're having panic attacks and oh my gosh, but it's to try to understand what is it that you're actually, what is it that you mean when you say that? And so for us to have a good working understanding of what a panic attack actually is, it's a surge of anxiety that lasts anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes. What you typically can find through that are heart rate increases really rapidly, quickly, sweating, chest pain, like they may be concerned of, like, am I having a heart attack? It's hard to breathe. I feel like I'm disoriented, where I'm feeling really dizzy in the room. There's shortness of breath. I may even complain of, like, stomach issues, and I feel like I'm sick. And so if you're hearing and seeing some of those things paired with what you are hearing and seeing that sounds like anxious, dread, worrying, that may be something that they're experiencing. And what, you know, that can be, panic attacks can be a really overwhelming and scary thing to feel, but also to see someone go through. And just to speak to it for a moment, if that is something that you're seeing your teen going through or hear them describing, I think sometimes we try our best to help our teen, and sometimes those intentions aren't necessarily that helpful. And so the worst thing that we can do, obviously as counselors and as people that are trying to come alongside them, is to tell them that what they're feeling is not what they're feeling, that they need to avoid it or think about and distract themselves and think about something else. What we know about panic attacks is that that's the worst thing that you could potentially do. It's actually going to increase the level of anxiety that you feel if you do that. And so what I try to walk people through who are describing panic attacks is to envision it like you are, once you are having a panic attack, you are having it. And so you need to accept that that is what you're feeling, but to take heart that panic attacks do end. They don't last forever. And so the picture that I try to describe is, hey, we're dropping you, like we're training you for Coast Guard training. We're dropping you in the middle of the ocean, maybe in the middle of a storm where you have waves that are all around you, and it looks really ominous and scary. And that's kind of what it can feel like to have a panic attack. You're in the middle of the ocean, but you have a life preserver on, and the life preserver is keeping you afloat, and you're going to stay above, and eventually that storm will pass, the waves will pass, and you're going to be taken out. That's the type of approach through working through a panic attack of trying to calm myself, breathe through it, recognize that I have hope that it's going to end. And as believers, like we appealed to at the beginning, we rest on a hope knowing that the Lord is sustaining us and carrying us through even a moment like that. So anxiety is a common thing that all humans feel from time to time. To clarify, it's considered to be unhealthy when the anxiety doesn't make sense, either because it's ringing the alarm that there's something immediately to be worried about, or the scale of anxiety is way out of proportion to the actual threat that we're actually dealing with. So I'll pass it to Anne and talking about when it may be good to potentially get help.
Okay, so yeah, so when to seek help. So we're looking at three things, duration, functioning, and coping. So is your child experiencing some of these symptoms for 2 weeks or longer? Would be kind of the technical duration. Are their grades dropping? I mean, are they not functioning? Are they withdrawing from friends? Are they isolating more? You know, so you're looking at the duration of the symptoms, and then their functioning, but then you're also looking at coping, and this can be a little confusing because teenagers may have symptoms that are very normal, like they're. You know, they're feeling anxious, they're feeling stressed, they're sad, they're going through hard things. But it's not like necessarily anxiety and depression, but they're not coping well. So unhealthy coping would be another reason to seek professional help. So it's not necessarily that they're having these acute anxiety disorder or acute depression, but they're just not coping well with just regular emotions that they're experiencing. Whether it's, you know, they're acting out in some ways, or they're angry at everybody in the room, you know, self-harm can be an unhealthy way of coping, you know, eating issues can be a coping strategy, you know, obviously drugs and alcohol, just those type of coping strategies. You would just want to, you know, even if the feelings don't seem like, well, she's not like depressed or anxious, but she's just not coping well, would be another reason to kind of get help. Y'all have any other?
Yeah,
can thoughts on that?
Yeah. Obviously, as counselors, we're speaking through a lens of when it may be good to get professional help from a counselor. But recognize that if we're not in crisis mode, either that there's other ways of reaching out for help too. You know, even considering being at Watermark Regen for students, that's obviously a good avenue to go through. It's just dependent upon where your teen is. So lots of teens to think about signing themselves up for. To go into a group and to be open and honest with the group, that just may be something that's really difficult for them to think about doing. And so just know that that's an option as well. And so considering different avenues and to try to come alongside your teen, recognizing that counseling is a good route to go. There are other great ministries, like I alluded to, Regen for Students is a great ministry as well. But anything to add to that?
Okay, are we gonna shift into the ways to help your teen? Okay, so we're kind of through hopefully some of the most depressing parts of the talk. Now we're gonna turn a little more hopeful, a little more action oriented. So it's not all gloom and doom. There's a lot that God can empower us to do and how we can partner with him in loving and caring for our teens. Number one is to educate yourself. So being here is an amazing first step at, you know, knowing what's going on in the world of mental health and teenagers. But I really wanted to speak to this topic because I have seen over the past couple years that teenagers are way more well-versed in mental health diagnoses, and some of them bring diagnoses into my office that I've never even heard of. And I just graduated from grad school 3 years ago, so I'm pretty up to speed. But all that to say, with access to things like social media, TikTok, there's a lot of education out there around mental health. Some of it is good and really helpful and normalizes things and helps kids not feel as alone. And then some of it, I have found, is not always the most helpful because there is some misinformation. There is sometimes a little over-dramatization or even just oversimplification of, like, signs you might have OCD and, like, pointing to, like, four fun little words in different colors. And it's like, oh, I guess I have OCD because I worry and I like things to be in order. And that's not the definition of OCD. So to kind of get a step ahead of your kids, if they are starting to bring up some of these terms, not to discount that and immediately write it off. If they're throwing a big term around of, like, you know, mom, I'm bipolar, or mom, I have OCD, or I have complex trauma, or whatever it is, to respond in a way that's compassionate and humble. And I like to just enter in with curiosity of, like Josh was talking about with panic attacks. Okay, tell me what you mean by that. Oh, where'd you learn that word? Okay, so what do you think means that you have OCD? Okay, so you're worried. And just kind of like try to assess and get an idea of what they're telling you. And then if it is pretty severe, seeking out professional help can help get more of a clear diagnosis. But I just bring that up and just so that you all know, yes, more research and more diagnoses are coming out over the years, but as professionals, we follow the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. We're on the 5th edition. The 6th edition is set to come out in the next couple years. And so just so you know, from a clinical standpoint, diagnoses are evolving and changing, but that takes a few years for that to happen. It really takes time based on the research that is conducted. So if your kid throws out a really big diagnosis at you, don't get too startled. Just get curious about it and then start to educate yourself. Do some research online. We also have a lot of great books and podcasts that we recommend that are very, like, digestible of translating complex terminology into just, like, real human terms. So we'll try to touch on that at the end, or y'all can come ask us about those. And then the next two, we kind of already talked about. I actually can't see what they are.
Seek professional help.
Mm-hmm. Seek professional help. Come to us. I'm just kidding. But if necessary, like Anne said, if the duration is significant, seek professional help. But also seek a support system. I like to tell parents that in a lot of ways, as a counselor, I am partnering with them, and I'm kind of saying the same exact thing their parents are saying at home, but from a source where they might have ears to hear it. When they're a teenager, they are in the process of individuating, and are right around like those middle school years. There's a significant shift from I go to mom and dad for all my help, I trust them with everything, to now I go to my best friend and all my peers for help, and I learn from them. And that can feel a little daunting and scary, but that's where other safe adults can be really helpful, like counselors, teachers, coaches, small group leaders, just other people to kind of have a set of eyes on them and to hopefully be speaking the same truth into their lives that you as mom and dad are already doing. And then this third one, just be mindful of the warning signs, to watch for all these signs that we've talked about today. And especially if it's more severe, if you see any signs of suicide, or we didn't quite mention this one, but self-harm. So any forms of cutting or burning is sadly another technique that kiddos will use through different just hot iron objects, to seek out professional help if you see any signs of that.
Thanks, Abby. Next slide. So with the fourth one, we're trying to keep open lines of communication. And as a guy who's primarily worked with teen males, I haven't seen a ton of the teen females, this can be a struggle, I think, at times even more so than trying to come alongside the teenage girl who may be more open just verbally. And so with the teens, which we're trying to, teen girls, we're trying to get them to actually express and be open about their emotions. With teen guys, I think that it's a greater source of success when us as parents are trying to understand more of their thought process rather than their feelings. And so just trying to ask questions that are more aimed at that of like, hey, like, help me understand what your thoughts were in regard to that. Feelings and thoughts are typically pretty closely connected, and we may have a better insight into what they may be experiencing as teen guys if we have a level of understanding of what their thought process is. But just trying to foster more open communication, knowing that it may be a little bit different depending upon if we're interacting with a female or a male. Like I said, the females may be a little more inclined to be sharing about their emotional.
Yeah, let me offer something on that. So in this good book called The Emotional Lives of Teenagers, girls tend to move to discussion to cope with their feelings, and boys tend to move into distraction to cope with their feelings. You may see that even in your own marriage, in your own relationships. And so it's just good to know. So the work is kind of with girls is to teach them how to distract, how to move into kind of healthy coping strategies. With boys, the work is more how to get them to open up and share what's going on inside of them, because they will quickly move to distraction, which is a good tool. But if you're not doing the work of noticing what you're feeling and experiencing that and sharing that, you're not going to benefit as much from really growing from those hard things. But just wanted to add that.
Great add.
Yeah.
We're attempting to keep open lines of communication, knowing that we're interacting with the teen. So it may not necessarily always be freely received. We're just trying to create that, right? And so creating that open environment where we're trying to do it through lack of judgment, truly listening, really listening to what they're saying, not seeking to give advice, giving first, but and trying to withhold, trying to fix them, but truly just hear where they're coming from. So take an interest in what interests them, speak and spend time with them, have fun with them, respect that they have an opinion, even if your opinions may differ. Going to number five, trying to create a safe environment at home. And so foster that home environment, hopefully where your teen feels safe and loved. Avoid criticizing them. Be patient with their progress. And I think a lot of times the appeal would be thinking about yourself as a teenager. Did you just quickly become who you are today? Or was that a progression over time? And so viewing your teen through that same lens of, hey, I've been a teenager before, and I now find myself, and life has progressed in a way where I've had challenges and I've had successes, and trying to view your child through that same lens. I think that at times as parents, we struggle with that because we don't want our kid to go through maybe something similar to what we've gone through. We don't want them to go through hardship, and that's understandable. But recognizing that a lot of times as a counselor, when we talk about the maturity of a person, we look at, you know, age 0 to 18 and think about the amount of change that happens in those years. It's pretty dramatic when you take someone who is 100% dependent, and then we're saying, hey, we're going to throw you out into the world at 18, and now you need to be more independent. Think about not only brain development, but just physical development. And you take an 18-year span from that point forward, there's not going to be as much dramatic change that happens in that 18-year period. And so as parents, what we're seeking to do is journey with our kid as they are hopefully growing towards independence. And so what starts as 100% dependence on you, if it was a perfect graph, it would be going up in a trajectory where as they grow, their independence is growing to the spot where they have more almost complete independence by the time that you're saying, okay, you're willing to go out there on your own.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
I want to add something to creating kind of a safe environment. I wanted to just address that listening is fixing. I think as parents, it's so anxiety provoking when your kids come to you with something that's really difficult. And so our tendency as a parent myself is to move in with reassurance, fixing, advice giving. And in general, kids tend to feel injured if that's your first response. You don't understand. So really moving in with listening and asking questions before moving in with coaching or a scripture or something like that. But it's hard as a parent when your kid is emotionally distraught. Like, we want to make them feel better immediately. But it just generally doesn't go well if you're not really listening, understanding, validating. And I mean, you'll see that in other relationships too, in your marriage, you know, if you move in too quickly with advice giving or fixing, you know, just sometimes that doesn't go over as well without feeling heard and understood first. And then the other thing about dealing with teenagers that doesn't create a safe environment that I just want to mention is teenagers are not emotionally regulated. So it's real easy to match them with their emotion. So as parents, it's really important to work on your own emotional regulation so that when you move in and have a conversation with your kids, you're not on the roller coaster with them. And that's why I'd say my husband and I are like, okay, we're ticket takers, just for deep breathing. We're not riding on the roller coaster with them. We're staying regulated. We're trying to stay calm. We're not, you know, I can't believe that, shooting off a text, reacting. And I'd say that's when I find, like, you know, when do you need to kind of go do some work? But it's hard to stay emotionally regulated when you're dealing with somebody who's really not, I mean, to be honest.
Yeah, thanks, anyway, Ann.
Yeah.
Yep. Moving to our sixth, which is encouraging healthy habits. Promote regular exercise, balanced diet, sufficient sleep, knowing that those can positively impact mental health. So when I have a teen that's in my office, those are kind of like the basics that we look at. If I have someone who's down, anxious, we're just kind of analyzing on the basics of how are we doing in regard to how much sleep are you getting? What does your diet look like? Are you getting outside at all? From a Christian perspective, are you seeking to grow that relationship at all? Just trying to come alongside them and encouraging healthier habits. And like we've reiterated, they're probably going to buck up against that as it's coming from you. And so encouraging them is very different than telling them what needs to be done. If you're just always telling them what they need to be doing, that's creating more of the pushback of, why would I want to do that? It feels like you're trying to control me and tell me what I need to do. And going back to what we were talking about before, we want to try to encourage them in the independence so that when they launch and they're 18, they are better equipped to do some of these things on their own because they've been navigating there already and trying to do it on their own rather than I've only done this because mom and dad have told me to do it and now I'm on my own and I'm not gonna eat what I should eat or I'm not gonna seek to develop my health in other ways. We also, point seven is looking to limit stressors. So help your teen manage their responsibilities and commitments to reduce stress. We live in a pretty fast-paced culture. Lots of teens have lots of stuff that's going on. I had someone in the office who was breaking down yesterday as a result of everything that he has going on. He's doing drum corps in the summer, which is, he feels like he has to stay on drumming like throughout every single day. He's in marching band. He just took on a new job. He's a senior in high school. He's trying to get applications out, and he literally just broke down. He has no time to actually just decompress, breathe. And so we were just looking at, hey, if we could change something, what would it be? What would it look like for us to actually change something? And so as parents, we want to try to foster that conversation as well of looking at the stressors. If we have someone who's really struggling with anxiety, depression, knowing that everything that they have on their plate right now may be a contributing factor to how they're feeling, and knowing how to best help them set some good parameters, good time management, setting realistic expectations. Acceptance that I cannot do it all is a good step. And I think that sometimes we just feel like I need to be able to do it all. And it's an indictment on me if I can't do it all. And so realizing that I have limitations is actually a good step to take. And going back to something that we were talking about a little bit earlier, if you see that their schedule is completely full and they can't handle everything, you may feel the tendency to hop in and just take something away from them. And again, that's not what we want to encourage you to do. We want to encourage you to come alongside, try to foster a conversation that says, hey, kind of walk me through what the day in and day out looks like. What feels stressful? What would it look like for you to change maybe how you're approaching this? What would it look like to maybe take something off of the plate right now? And just trying to encourage it rather than saying, this is what you must have to do. Obviously, if we're in crisis mode, going back to some of the more intense suicidality, that's where we kind of hop in and say, no, I need to do something to take something from you for your benefit. But this is more of a, we're not in crisis. We're seeking to just kind of come alongside. Point eight, and I take a deep breath because this is probably the one that I anticipate having the most tension on, which is monitoring screen time. Knowing that in our culture, regardless of age, we're spending tons of time on our screens, but in particular, teens are spending tons of time on their screens. And so, as I think Happy alluded to, screens, they can get a bad rap. And I think that what we're kind of looking at is how much social media time, interacting with other people, are you actually doing when you're on screens, knowing that that avenue can be a lot of complication to feeling depressed and anxious. You can be on a screen and do a variety of other things. You can do research and grow your level of knowledge on something. You can entertain yourself that isn't a social media form. And that would be different than what we see teens primarily really struggling with when we see anxiety and depression, which is lots of social media, knowing that that is the connection a lot of times and what is contributing as a complication. Did you have something to add to that?
Yeah, I was going to add something I see a lot with some of my more on the severe side of depression clients, and excessive screen time and starting to seek out and find community almost primarily and solely online and not having really any in-person true friends. And that's usually a pretty major concern for me. I mean, it's not a bad thing to have friends through an online forum, but it cannot provide the same life-giving engagement that face-to-face interaction. I think that has a lot to do with the way that God made us to be embodied creatures for embodied community. And so if you notice that your kid is spending hours and hours online and maybe like mentioning friends or even like groups that they're identifying as a part of that you're like, I don't know where this is coming from. Just like keep an eye out for that. And that is something that we as counselors can work with or you as parents can help with of just trying to nudge them out of the house and in front of other people, even if it's in group settings where they're like, oh, I don't like these people. None of them are like my true friends. It is just still good for them to get face to face in front of other people. That's just a trend I've been seeing over the past couple of years that really does concern me where social media and even just the internet and different forums are providing like kind of this false sense of intimacy and belonging and identity that it's not sustainable. It's kind of a band-aid, but then over time it collapses pretty quickly. And really face-to-face friendships can only, I think, provide like that depth and longevity of true connection.
Yeah, great. So just in summary, we're just saying it would be good to monitor screen time if we're seeing that our teen is struggling with anxiety, depression, and to just kind of screen what's going on. It's different if we don't have any indication that our teen is struggling at all. They're doing great. Then I don't think that it would be good to be heavy-handed and say, hey, I need to monitor all your screen time. We're talking about more of we have a teen that's actually struggling and are wondering if that is a contributing factor to how you're struggling. And nine is encourage social connections, which is what Happy was just kind of alluding to there, of supporting your teen and maintaining their own personal friendships and engaging in activities that they enjoy. I know that Anne's going to speak to 10, which is modeling a lot of this, which I can double back on, that if we're saying, hey, these are things that are good for you to try to encourage and come alongside your teen, you have a better foot to stand on if you're actually doing some of these things yourself. So I'll pass it to Anne.
Yeah. And I'm going to, because we do want to leave a little time for questions, so I'll kind of zip through these a little bit. But model self-care. Are you taking care of yourself? If you have a teen struggling with anxiety and depression, it can be really difficult and hard and emotional. And so you want to take care of yourself if you're supporting a teen who's got, you know, significant mental health issues. So, you know, are you working all the time? Are you stressed out? Are you taking time to regulate, to relax? Are you seeking your own support, your own community? And those would be, you know, that's kind of what you're modeling to your kids. Are you eating healthy? You know, all those things. And then you may need your own support if your teen is really struggling. And that could be professional, but it could also be just your community and close friends who can pray for you. The one caveat to that is that teens don't really like you to tell other people all their business. So I think it's good to find a respectful way of sharing their stories, you know, with the people in your communities, and even maybe telling them who you'd like to share with and who you'd like to get support from, so that they know. And then finally, be patient. I mean, adolescence is a long journey in and of itself, and it takes time, let alone a child who's really struggling with anxiety and depression. It's not a quick fix. Just be patient, and, you know, as you walk with them on that journey. So any other thoughts before we kind
of I just wanted to chime in. One of our favorite little sayings we have on staff is, children are great observers, but not great interpreters. So just be wary of that, that they are constantly taking in, observing your behavior, how you're regulating your own emotions. They're not always going to interpret it a perfect way, but knowing that just modeling healthy behaviors for them is one of the greatest strengths that you have as a parent. Okay, y'all want to move on to Q&A?
Yeah, we'd love to toss it to you guys if you have any questions for us. Do you need a mic? Okay.
And I'll come bring the mic.
Do you want to speak to medication? Do we want to kind of talk about that? I mean, if you have a question, raise your hand. But
do you have a question? Okay. Okay. Thumbs up on medication.
Speaking to medication.
Yeah. It's on.
I think there's a lot of misconceptions when it comes to medication. So it's a good tool. And again, the sooner you treat anxiety and depression, the more likely you are to have a recovery from it. So my thought is go talk to a professional. Talk to a psychiatrist that understands medication and knows how they work. I think it's a good tool, and there's a time when it's really helpful, especially when you're considering the duration and the severity of it. My recommendation when I'm dealing with parents or even individuals who have like resistance to that is, I'd encourage you to talk to somebody who knows what they're doing, like not online, but who really understands how medication works. And make more of kind of an informed decision with a professional. And we have some great psychiatrists that we refer to that are believers and understand kind of that struggle that it can be at times. And so I think they're great resources for us, and happy to pass them along. Anybody else have any thoughts?
Yeah, I have some thoughts on that. So yeah, you have a question? Okay.
So for boys, how do you go around the question like, nah, I don't need therapy, and you really think that it would be good for them to seek help?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I have a parent who's verbalizing something similar, to force them to go to therapy is never going to be a great option. So you can continue to try to have conversation with them of why you feel like it would be a benefit, but I typically don't say, hey, let's bring them as they're kicking and screaming into the office, because that's just going to be a waste of my time, their time, your money. And so, you know, have continual conversation, building the case of why you feel like it would be a benefit, but don't force them to go to a counselor. And, you know, a lot of times what I try to give parents are real tangible takeaways of what it looks like to come to counseling, because I think a lot of times teens have a preconception of what they think that they're signing themselves up for based upon what either a friend has told them or what they've seen on TV or read online, which is, hey, only crazy people go to counseling. And so it's actually kind of creating more of a normative approach. And so when I talk to parents, it's, hey, truly in that first time, I'm just trying to get to know who they are. If I'm going to try to establish if it is, if counseling is something that is beneficial for you, then I actually got to know who it is I'm actually interacting with. And so just starting a understanding of who are you, what do you like to do, talk about mom and dad. That's what we're going to be spending some time doing. And so that would be my answer to that. But before, to get your thoughts, if you have any on that, but I wanted to speak to medication just for a second as well. We all view medication as a helpful resource, but it's not the thing that we are jumping to first and foremost, unless we're dealing with crisis again. Like, if we're dealing with crisis, then we need to have some adjustment of where they are chemically. But if we have someone who's not in crisis, it's a, hey, let's try to enter in and see if we can do some work here where we don't need to have medication. Can we mitigate some of the things that we're struggling with from a depressed or anxious spot? And using that as a, if I have someone in my office, we're having really good conversation, we're making really good headway, and we're just hitting our head up against the wall over and over and over again, and we can't really get over the hurdle, then that's where I start to include that conversation, which is like, can we include something else that would help us get over the hurdle? And maybe medication would be something that would be helpful at that point in time. But it's not the thing that I'm jumping to in the first session, the first couple of sessions. We're actually trying to have some level of understanding of what's going on. What does it look like for us apart from medication to see if we can actually get the ball rolling? And if not, then kind of going that route at that point in time. Yeah. She's got a mic.
Unpacking a little bit the avoid criticism way of supporting our teens. When you're confronted with a need for behavior modification and how to communicate in a way that is not seen as criticism, and I think Anne touched upon when we receive their, when they come to us and avoiding the need, the urge to jump and try to fix them. But when you need to initiate that conversation, how can you do that without being critical?
Yeah.
Mina?
Sure.
Yeah, I'll give you two quick things I say to parents. I mean, when my kids come at me hot and kind of angry, a lot of times I say, hey, you know what? I really want to hear what you're feeling, but how you're saying it isn't working. So let's take a minute, let's calm down, and let's try again. Just a boundary. And then maybe not doing it in the moment, which I think is just a general parenting thing, is that once someone's calmed down, like even your toddler's calmed down or your child, then you move into, hey, I've noticed, like, you're really coming in, the last few times after school, you're really coming in hard towards your sister. What's going on? And even just saying, you know what, that's not going to work. We've got to find a better way to express ourselves. So in the moment, just a boundary, rather than don't talk to me that way, that's unacceptable, that's disrespectful, like, that's not going to work, but just a kind boundary. Hey, I don't, that's not going to work. That would be my first thing to say. Is that kind of what you're looking for? Yeah. But they need to be corrected, just sometimes maybe not in the moment.
One other quick tool that I like to recommend for parents is the ABCs of limit setting. So depending on the situation, because you were kind of alluding to, like, if there needs to be some behavior modification, if what they're doing is not within the bounds of what y'all think is okay, it's parents. ABCs, address the feeling. So always start with the feeling of, like, man, I hear that you are frustrated, or I hear you're so upset about this. Acknowledge the behavior, but sneaking out of the house at night or throwing a tantrum is not a way that we deal with our anger. And then the C is name a choice or a consequence. So you can choose to obey our rules and then we'll let you go out this weekend, or you can choose to keep breaking the rules and you're going to be grounded, or whatever that is. So giving kids a choice a lot of times helps bring the temperature down a little bit and give them a little bit of autonomy in how we handle some consequences that they might not enjoy.
Hi. We've done counseling together, and so our counselor talked to us about, like, the idea of the mirror neurons and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you had any other practical tips in dealing with your teen when they're like super unregulated, because it makes me feel like very unregulated too. So like, what can I do to like calm down myself so we can have like an actual conversation, or I don't know, be able to listen to them instead of doing that advice and stuff, because it makes me feel like really heightened, like I want to run away from them.
Right.
Like I can't handle you right now and you can't handle me, and so maybe we shouldn't talk. But
yeah.
First of all, just a really good book that just came out. Sissy Goff wrote The Worry-Free Parent. I mean, it's really a great book on anxiety, regulating yourself, parenting. I highly recommend it. There's in that book, there's lists of regulation tools. But there's times where I'm not regulated and my husband has to take over. Or I just say, hey, like let's just pause. Like let's go make a cup of tea. You know, go take a shower. Let's take five. I mean, anytime I think you're finding your anxieties up, it's okay to just say, let's talk in 5 minutes. Can you give me a minute? It would be if you find that you're escalating or you're getting emotional. But realizing you don't have to fix it, like that really them dumping on you is fixing it, like that's can help even calm you down. Like, they're just... they're going to feel better when they're done. So I can contain this, can help, rather than, oh my gosh, they're a mess and I've got to fix it and now we have a huge problem. When they're coming to you and just, just vomiting all over you with their emotion, they really are doing the work. And the studies say that if kids can identify what they feel and express it, like that in and of itself can build resilience. You don't have to fix the emotion. So sometimes that helps me. I'm like, okay, even though I feel like this is awful, maybe it's not as awful as I think. They're just, you know, dumping on me in a sense. Kind of what I say. I don't know if that helps, but the book's really good. It gives you a lot of tools in there.
And we're not going to do it perfectly, right?
Like no.
We're going to get in. We're going to not feel regulated ourselves. We are going to give advice when I'm telling myself I don't want to give advice. And so when recognizing that we're seeking to not do those things, when we recognize, hey, I missed it there, then it's coming back to that teen and maybe even expressing an apology of I'm so sorry that I handled it that way. But recognizing that, you know, we're not going to do it perfectly mm-hmm. either, and giving ourselves tons of grace as parents. The incredibly difficult but rewarding job.
The Worry-Free Parent, Sissy Goff, Worry-Free Parent. It's a great book. It's just out.
Yeah. We are past time, 12:33. Lunch is at 12:30. If you have a question, we'd be willing to answer anything and stay up here for a couple of minutes, but want to make sure you get lunch and don't miss out on whatever they have. Thanks, guys.